Good morning, everyone. Before I actually give my message for the day, I'd like to make a couple comments about Father's Day in 2 weeks. Did you ever think about, we make a big deal of Mother's Day. Does sometimes seem like we make more mothers than fathers? Maybe fathers aren't quite as important? But don't buy the thought. Don't buy it. You are extremely important in your child's life. In Proverbs 17:6, it says, "The glory of children is their fathers." God has given fathers a window of time, maybe up to adolescent or so, where your children will basically believe whatever you say. Maybe there's a limit to that, but more or less. What you teach your children, they're going to believe. My dad had John Deere tractors. That meant John Deere tractors were the best. That could be a hot topic in school. I don't remember that I necessarily had that feelings about my mother. I've heard this from others as well, that there's something about dad I think it's probably a God thing, a God built it there. You have a glorious opportunity to get your children started on the right path, to build a spiritual foundation in their life. There's a young man that gave a talk at Encourage Men. I don't know if ever you've heard about that. He talked about the father wound. And he said in his talk about how he craved the affirmation from his father. If his father commended him for something that he did well, he said it was just like fireworks to him. You know, it wanted him to, I guess, try harder. I think he said what he craved more than anything was to hear his father say, "I love you." I take it from the way he said it that his dad never had. I think I might just send that. I plan to just send that message around on the chat, anyone that feels like listening to it. Now, after saying that, I want to read a couple verses out of Psalms 144. This thought I'm giving is not really original with me. In Psalms 144, David, I presume, is more or less talking about a literal fight, a literal battle. Maybe he was looking at the spiritual side too, but he says, in verse 1, he says, "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight." Then I want to jump down to verse 12 to 15, "That our sons may be as plants grown up in their youth, that our daughters may be as a cornerstone polished after the similitude of a palace, that our garners may be full, affording all manner of store, that our sheep may bring forth thousands and ten thousands in our streets, that our oxen may be strong to labor, that there be no breaking in or going out, that there be no complaining in our streets. Happy is the people that is in such a case, yea, happy is that people whose God is the Lord." The idea being, if we're conquering the enemy, then things can go well at home. Then our families can flourish. Now apply that to the spiritual life. Hopefully to the end of today's message, you'll be able to piece that together and figure out how that fits in. Okay, now this is my message for the day. Is there anyone in this room that has never had anything bad happen in your life? I presume not. So why do bad things happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why did God allow this to happen in my life? I would have had a good life if that hadn't happened. I would have had a good life if I hadn't been born with, you name it. I'd have had a good life if he or she hadn't done that. I had a good life if you fill in the blank, whatever your situation may be. Why do you have such a struggle with this temptation to sin? In Genesis 1:31, God's looked at his creation and said, God looked at everything he had made and it was very good. If you look at Genesis 1, 29 and 30, just a little comment I want to make there to kind of illustrate what all this meant. And God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which the fruit of the tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat, and to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything which creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat," or for food. And it was so. So there wasn't even death among the animals. This is the type of world God created. Nothing bad happens. Well, as you know, sin came into the world. And I want to read a couple verses out of Genesis 3. 17 to 19. This is where God gave the consequences, what's going to happen now. And to man, he said, Genesis 3:17. "And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return." Now, was the only thing that happened for Adam is that he had to work hard and there would be thorns and thistles growing? It's a little bit broader than that. I'll use the word thorns and thistles kind of figuratively. If you have been born in this life, then you are promised thorns and thistles in your life. When Job and his friends were talking, one of Job's friends made the comment, "People are born for trouble as readily as sparks fly up from a fire." If you look at kind of the thought behind of what Jesus said in Matthew 7 when he's talking about temptations, he says, "Woe unto the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom temptations come." That's out of the ESV. The same idea. It doesn't say that this is right, but this is the way it's going to be. And as far as troubles, that's the way it's going to be. There's going to be things coming in your life. So, in a way, the things that have happened in your life have not messed it up. The things that have happened in your life have, in one sense of the word, only made it normal. You're not different than everyone else. We all have our individual thing. We all have troubles. In John 16:33, at the Last Supper, Jesus had said various things to his disciples, and then he says, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." The title of my message today is Be an Overcomer. Overcome your troubles, overcome your temptations. And by the way, I'm in no way claiming to have all the answers for whatever it is you might be going through. There's a lot I don't know. Now, when we look at the word overcomer, especially if you think of it in an Old Testament sense, what picture might that bring to your mind to overcome? Maybe you think of a battle. That's one place where you overcome. You overcome the enemy. The first point that I want to make is identify your enemy. Think of your troubles in life. Identify your enemy. Now, a couple Bible accounts to illustrate what I'm talking about. In the days of Hezekiah, the Assyrians came and camped against Jerusalem. And the king of Assyria sent messengers with a letter to discourage the Jews and blaspheme God. And I don't think Hezekiah ever dealt or talked with the king himself. He only interacted with the messengers. But he understood fully the king was the real enemy, not these men he's talking to. And when God sent his rebuke to the Assyrians, he sent it to the king. He didn't direct his rebuke to the messengers. Getting at the thought, recognize who the enemy is. It might not be the person you're dealing with. So who is the real enemy for us? It's Satan. When Jesus was tempted by Satan in the couple verses out of Matthew 4. Okay, Matthew 4, I'm going to read verse 3, 5, and 8. Okay, Jesus had came to him to tempt him after Jesus was fasting. And when the tempter came to him, he said, If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. Verse 5. Then the devil taketh him up to the holy city and setteth him on a pinnacle of the temple. And verse 8. Again, the devil taketh him into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. As far as I can see, Jesus met Satan face to face. Have you ever? That's generally not. I don't know if there's any human being that has met Satan face to face like that. For us, Satan works through circumstances. He works through people. He works through thoughts. He works through the happenings in your life to try to conquer you. And his goal is to kill, steal, and destroy. If you think of Job, I don't think you need to turn there. You basically know the story. So God and Satan were talking. And Satan says, just take Job's wealth away and he'll curse you to your face. So God allowed Satan to do that. There was an enemy group that came and stole his camels. There was a different enemy group that came and stole his, I forget what it was. And the messenger said the fire of God, he called it the fire of God, fell from heaven and burned up the sheep. And then a wind came and destroyed his, killed his children. Now, on the surface, it would appear the enemy, Job's got big problems here. The enemy is the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans, or forget what it was. Or maybe even God's against me. Fire fell from heaven. That wasn't the real enemy. The real enemy was Satan, was trying to get Job to curse God. It wasn't the Chaldeans. They were only the tool that Satan was using. So I'm saying, identify your enemy. Sometimes our troubles involve people, and we have to deal with relationships. But the real enemy is Satan. Let's remember that. If we forget who our real enemy is, he might just end up conquering us more. For example, think of David and Bathsheba. David got involved with Uriah's wife. Now David is in big trouble. He's got huge trouble in his life. The law said if you committed adultery, the penalty was death. So who's going to be the one that finds this out? Uriah is the only one that is going to be able to find this out. So in David's mind, Uriah is the problem. I got to deal with Uriah. And he did. And in the process, he only fell deeper into Satan's trap. His real enemy was Satan. Your real enemy is not your brother. It's not your coworker, not your boss, not your neighbor. It's not whoever you might be happening to think about right now. Now, it's true, we have to deal with our relationships with people if our troubles happen to involve a person. But let's deal with them God's way. Then Satan won't be the victor. Just an example of how you deal with someone God's way. If it's like an enemy, someone who's against you, in Romans 12, it gives the teaching. If your enemy hungers, feed him. Then the end it says, don't be overcome with evil, overcome evil with good. If you respond to a literal enemy in that way, you conquered Satan, your real enemy, regardless how your enemy might happen to respond. Regardless how your physical enemy might happen to respond. You have conquered your real enemy. Now, I said overcome might make you think of a battle. There are several ways to make a battle end. One, you can compromise or surrender to your enemy. Number two, you can run. Or number three, you can conquer. So surrender / compromise, run, or conquer. Now, let's keep in mind, as we look at examples of battles in the Old Testament, but apply it to your spiritual life, your troubles. Don't get mixed up what we're talking about. How do these principles apply to the battles I face in life? First example I want to look at is in 1 Samuel 11. This was right after Saul was anointed king. Or soon after it, I should say. First Samuel 11. Let's start by reading verse 1 and 2. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead. And the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us, and we will serve thee. So they're ready to compromise and surrender right off the bat. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for reproach upon all Israel. Why were they ready to surrender right off the bat? I don't know if he had a big army, what the deal was. They might have thought, we can't. We can't overcome him. We're helpless. I can't. That makes me think of Moses when God asked him to do something he looked at as hard. Delivering the children of Israel. I can't. I've been born with this problem. I can't do this. I can't. Well, if it's something that God is really calling us to, then we have the promise in Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. If God is actually calling us to it, we need to look to that promise. So, with the men of Jabesh Gilead here, what would surrender have looked like? Being partially blinded, partially handicapped? So, what would surrender look like in the battles we face? Whatever that may be in your life. Now remember who your enemy is. Don't get this confused, especially if you're dealing with a person. Satan's your enemy. What would it look like if you surrendered to your enemy through this trial that's in your life? It's not your troubles. That's only the avenue that your enemy is attacking you in. When we have bad attitudes about our situation, when we give in to negative thinking, or engage in wrong actions, isn't that the same as being conquered by our enemy? And if we're responding in that way, negative thinking, bad actions, as likely as not, we're believing lies. And if we're believing lies, we're being blinded. Same as an example we read. It's the truth that will set us free. Okay, so what are some of these lies we might be believing? I mean, the list could be a long list. We bought this book. It's by that fat, big book. It's used in, a counselor would use it to work through a person who's seeking help. The first lesson, the first sentence of the book, it says, I just feel so worthless. Have you ever felt that? Apparently there's a lot of people that have felt that. It's a lie. Another lie we might subtly be believing is everything always goes wrong for me. Be careful of those always, words like that. Or maybe you subtly think God doesn't care. Now you might not say those words, but be careful that we don't subtly in our heart think that. Or I deserve to have this happen to me. Nobody loves me. These are lies. Troubles are a part of life. Let's not let Satan defeat us. Let's not let Satan use them to defeat us. Okay, back to our story here in 1 Samuel. I'm going to read the next verse. And the elders of Jabesh said unto him, unto the enemy, give us 7 days respite, and we will send messengers unto all the coasts of Israel. And then, if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee. So they did one thing right. They asked for help. That can be a good idea if your troubles seem overwhelming. The point is, who did they ask help from? They ask help from their brothers, from the other Israelites. Now, there's another account. In 2 Chronicles 16, King Asa had an army coming against him, and he turned to the heathen for help. And it seemed to work, but there was consequences. God sent a prophet to him. God was not happy with what he did. You You know, God remembers that we're dust. If we need to ask for help, that can be all right. But let's sure that we're turning to godly counsel, godly help. The prophet told King Asa, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him." Surrendering to our enemy, if you think of this Bible story right here, surrendering to our enemy when we face life's troubles is not a good option. Okay, the second point was running. Now, that's something that some people do. And to explain what I mean by running, Christian Yee said this story. They got a call from a man. Probably it was the billboard evangelism that got the call. He said, "That billboard has to come down. I'm driving so many minutes out around every day on my way to work so I don't have to see it." What was he doing? He was running from his problem. Driving out around so he didn't have to see it. I read this book about this family that moved, I don't know, several times they moved in life. And the children later were talking with each other, and they commented that it seemed that when things got hot for Dad, then he moved. It's the same idea. He's running from his problems. Instead of working through them, instead of being an overcomer, he would run. So, again, let's look at a Bible story at a time when Israel fled. 1 Samuel 31. I'm going to read verse 1 and verse 7. 1 Samuel 31. "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines." They ran and fell down slain in Mount Gilbo. And just jumping down to verse 7. "And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley and they that were on the other side of Jordan saw that the men of Israel fled and that Saul and his son were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them." Also, if you think about the time in Judges when the Midianites, in the time of Gideon, when the Midianites came, it says that the Israelites basically the idea that they went and they hid in dens and caves and strongholds in the mountains and whatever. The same idea. Instead of conquering their enemy, they fled. Obviously, there was a reason they couldn't, because they weren't right with God. But it's the idea, running from the enemy makes your life smaller. You no longer have as full of a life as you could. It takes away when you run from your enemy. That man, he was not free to drive on the road anymore because we didn't want to see this sign. It reduced his life. If you're constantly being chased around because you don't want to face your problems, you're just moving, it takes away from your life. It puts you in a box. You're not free to enjoy all that God has for you. Now, Christ was an overcomer. What can we learn from his example? Well, in the temptations in the wilderness, you know that when Satan was tempting him, he responded with God's word. The other, and just some more verses that go with that out of Psalms, "Thy word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." If we're hiding God's word in our heart, it can save us from falling into Satan's trap. "Thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee." The other example I want to look at is in the Garden of Gethsemane. So in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was wrestling in prayer. Now the question is, who or what was he wrestling with? Was he wrestling with God? I think if you really stop and think about it, what he was really wrestling with was his own will. He was wrestling with himself. He knew what God had for him, but he was wrestling with laying down his own will to go through with it. I pointed to Satan as being our main enemy, our real enemy. But isn't self one of the main tools that Satan will use to try to get us? My own will. In fact, you could say that there's times when Satan doesn't even have to bother tempting us, since our own carnal nature is working quite well without him. In 1 Peter, Peter had been talking here about suffering wrongfully, and then starting to read at verse 21, talking about Christ. After he talked about the suffering wrongfully, for even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also hath suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow in his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. That last phrase, committed himself, that speaks of faith. I told you I got this big book that counselors use. Now, I didn't read much in the book yet, but I think the entire book can basically be summed up in a sentence or two. They're teaching you to understand what God says and believe it. Quoting a verse does not mean that I believe it, and teaching a verse to someone else does not mean that I believe it. I read a story. Actually, I heard this story when I was a child. We had it on a record. Later, I read it in the book, so it must be pretty... It's a true story. This missionary was on... I'm not sure if it was an island or where it was, but anyway, he was ministering to these people, and it wasn't raining. And so eventually, the natives, him and the natives, got together to pray for rain. Well, they had announced it that they're going to get together to pray for rain. And the natives all showed up to the prayer meeting with umbrella hats on. The computer said umbrellas, so whether it was umbrellas or umbrella hats is beside the point. The point was, not the natives just had simple faith. There wasn't a specific promise that they were trusting in. But they had faith. You could see they had faith because they showed up expecting it to rain. That's an example of having faith. I said before, just because I can quote a verse doesn't say that I'm really believing it. And then when we talk of believing God's promises, we often, at least maybe for me, I often think of believing positive things, you know, all the good things God will do for us. Well, believing what God says also, it refers to everything God said. Like, for instance, follow peace with all men and holiness without which no man shall see the Lord. Do we believe that? We will not see the Lord without holiness? We can quote it. Do we believe it? In 1 Peter 5:7 says, cast all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Do we believe he really cares? Another story of a missionary. I don't remember where I read this. This missionary was sick. And on top of all that, the support check didn't come. For 30 days, she had nothing to eat but oatmeal. Well, the support check eventually did come, and she went to a doctor. And the doctor says, you can be glad your support check didn't come. For the condition you had, a 30-day oatmeal diet was the best thing you could have done. Now, in that case, we can see, yes, God was caring. Sometimes we don't literally see how this all works out. I should say many times, I think we don't see, at least at the time. But we need to believe it. We don't interpret God's promises according to our experience. We interpret our experience according to God's promises. In 1 John 5:4, it says, for whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world, and this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. So let's go over the points. Number one, Satan is the real enemy. Not your troubles, not the people that you are, if there are people involved in the troubles. They're not the enemy, it is Satan. Compromising or surrendering to Satan is not an acceptable way to deal with our troubles or to deal with relationships. Running from our problems is not overcoming them. It puts you in a box. It only makes life smaller. It only takes away from what God would have for you. Overcoming self could be a key factor in rising above your problems. And one more passage I want to read out of Romans 8. Romans 8, starting at 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As is written, for thy sake we are killed all day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. Now back to the verse I read at the beginning. Blessed be the Lord, which my strength with teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight.